today's another topic, which may sound boring, you know, at the start, right? But we'll try to make it exciting. And I think we've been able to make most topics exciting despite the fact that when you first think about it, they sound boring. The next mitzvah I want to discuss is, it's found in Parshas Korach, in the book of Bamidbar. There's a mitzvah to guard the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. Mitzvah to guard the temple. It says, I'll read it to you, Hashem, this is chapter 18, book of Bamidbar. Hashem tells Aaron, you and your children and your father's household should take on the burden of the temple, and you and your children with you shall carry the burden of the kahuna, of the priesthood. Also the tribe of Levi as well should come with you and should support you and accompany you and serve you. And this says, they shall guard your guard and guard the tent, meaning the temple. They should make sure that nobody approaches the holy vessels or the altar. And then you won't have to die. Meaning, if you don't do your job and guard properly, there actually is a heavenly death penalty or such a thing. That's how serious it is. And it continues. It says you shall guard the guarding of the sacred, and you should guard the altar, and there shouldn't be any anger against the Jewish people. So it goes on in a few more descriptions, but the idea is a mitzvah that we shall guard the Beis HaMikdash, guard the temple. So first let's discuss how they guard the temple, what that means, and then we'll discuss, you know, the meaning of the mitzvah, that's what we can learn from it. So the mitzvah is upon the Kohanim and Levim, the priests and the Levites. They should guard the temple. The way it worked is the Kohanim were stationed inside the walls, and they'd guard from the inside, and the Levites were stationed outside the walls, they'd guard from the outside. The Mishnah teaches us there are 24 guards nightly stationed around the temple grounds. 21 were Levites, and they were stationed, like we said, outside the walls. And 3 of them were Kohanim, they'd be stationed inside the walls. So it'd be good to have a visual of this, but you had your temple courtyard with the walls surrounding it. The Kohanim stood guard on the inside, 3 of them, and 21 Levites stood guard on the outside. It's interesting, there was actually a patrol that would go around to make sure that they stayed awake, because you're talking about guarding all night long, because they might fall asleep. So there was a patrol of Kohanim that would go around to make sure that the guards were doing their job and staying awake. And the Mishnah tells us that if they came to a guard and he was sleeping, they could hit him with a stick. And then, if that didn't work, they were even allowed to set his clothes on fire. Which sounds pretty scary. But that's how serious they took this job. They could set their clothes on fire. Yeah.
Did they ever really do it?
They did. Yeah, they actually did it. It says the mission, they actually did it. So, you know, there are times where they wake up screaming. Everyone can hear them screaming, my clothes are on fire. You know, but it's a fascinating thing. But they took it very seriously, this job. They took it so seriously that they even let you set their clothes on fire to make sure they were awake. So what was the job of these guards? What were they guarding against? And it's very interesting because this is God's palace, the Beis HaMikdash. This is God's house. And we know that God guards the entire world. Every human being is guarded by God. We know that God is the guard of the Jewish people. We know that we put up our mezuzahs on our doors of our homes, and the mezuzah is supposed to be for us a symbol of God's protection. And the name of God in the mezuzah, Shaddai, Shin, Dawad, Yod, many commentators say it could stand for the idea of Shomer Diros Yisrael, that God guards the dwellings of the Jewish people. He's Shomer Diros Yisrael. He guards the dwellings of Israel. So God guards our dwellings. So why do we have to guard God's dwelling? Why do we guard in the Beis HaMikdash? It's a very interesting thing. So the sages teach us that the idea of the guards wasn't to protect it from enemies or bandits or thieves or the like. The idea of the guards was, and I'll read you the quote, they say, you can't compare a palace that has guards to a palace with no guards. Meaning it was a type of honor given to the palace of God. When you walk up to a building and it's surrounded by guards, so sometimes they're there to protect the building, sometimes it's part of the honor, it's an honor guard. They're there to show the significance of the building which is there, even though they're not doing all that much. The famous changing of the guard, Buckingham Palace, I don't know if those guards really do much guarding, right? But it shows the honor of the palace, right? It shows that there is a very important building over here that we have to protect. So we're not protecting it in terms of the fear of enemies. We're giving it honor by placing guards around it. So the idea of these guards, one idea of these guards, it's an honor guard. That's what it was. It's there to show honor to the building which is there. And the truth is, the Beis HaMikdash was supposed to be a building that evoked honor and awe from all who approached it. Even non-Jews approach the temple and feel the awe of God, because they saw them. They saw the external trappings of this amazing, incredible building with the guards and the beautiful materials it was made out of, and the marble and the gold and the silver and the great architecture that was there. And that was supposed to lead them to understand the greatness of God Himself. So in terms of this point, I want to understand a deeper lesson which is here. What's the lesson of this? The fact that a building which has guards is much more significant or honorable than building without guards. So this is an idea which I think we've discussed before in this class, but it bears repeating. I think it's an important idea. And it's a lesson of the power of, you know, externals. Now you could say, wait a minute, the Beis HaMikdash is a building which is supposed to be the center of spirituality for the world. So forget the gold and the silver, forget the guards, forget the marble, forget any of the fanfare. It could be an old dilapidated building, because it's all about what's happening on the inside. Forget the outside. Why is the outside important? You know, we look at people and we say externals aren't that important. It matters, what's on the inside matters. Now, don't judge a book by its cover. Now, we have many ways in which we approach people and understand that we can't focus on the externals, let's focus on the internals, which is true. But on the basis of Mikdash, you get there, and you see this building, which is not only beautiful internally. I mean, you have there the sacrificial service, you had constant miracles, you had the Kohanim, you had the Levim, you had a building which was tremendously spiritual, and you could walk in there and feel the presence of God. But yet, there's a major focus on the externals as well. And the question is why? And the idea is, if we just take maybe like an analogy for a second. Now, let's say somebody wants to give you a gift of a diamond ring. So they brought you a diamond ring in a brown paper bag. No, so it doesn't, something is not so, it's kind of off. It doesn't quite make sense. When you buy a diamond ring, they give you a fancy little jewelry case to put it in. So the casing actually represents what's inside. If someone walks around the big brown paper bag, you don't think a diamond ring's inside. Maybe you have one in there, I don't know. Right? But nobody thinks there's a diamond ring inside the paper bag because it's a paper bag. And you know, usually the case is there to direct us, to indicate what's inside. And that's how all life is. You know, we dress up for special events. I mean, the event be the same whether you're wearing a t-shirt or whether you're wearing a suit. But dressing up for a special event is because we're trying to show we're about to enter into a significant event, which is very, very important, and therefore we want to dress for the occasion. The reason that we would, you know, you go into more upscale stores, even though their bags will be a little bit nicer, because the clothing you're buying hopefully is nicer, you never know. But, you know, they want to indicate that, you know, this store is really high quality stuff, and therefore we're giving you a fancy bag to indicate that the contents of the bag is actually very, very, also high quality. So when you talk about externals, there's an idea of, you know, the Torah recognizes externals as something very important. Not as an end into itself, but as a means to an end. The external is supposed to show you that when the externals are pointing that there's something special here, then the inside should be something special. The externals should match the internals. So therefore, you go to the Beis HaMikdash, and you see this gorgeous building. And you know, there's a lot of description of it in the prophets, in the Mishnah. We have some sort of, you know, people have rendered different mock-ups and models and, you know, artistic portrayals of the Beis HaMikdash. And you can see it's beautiful. Now you see that there's a certain shape to the building. And you see what the building is made out of. And it was decorated with certain types of windows. And there was gold, and there was silver, and there was marble, and there was, things were symmetrical, and there was designs, and there was different tapestries which were around. And it was a beautiful building. And you'd walk in there, even if you didn't know what it was, you'd be just in awe of the building itself. It's a beautiful place to go. But the point of that was to show that this is the building in which one could connect to the creator of the world. That the external trappings of this building were pointing to something much deeper inside. So when you see the guards outside, even though the guards, they're not doing anything. I mean, you can see they're wasting their time. Why are they standing around, 24 people every single night, guarding the building? But the point is to show the world that this building is something special. And everyone has to know that. If the building was just, you know, it was a log cabin, and nobody guarded it. You walked inside and it had old carpet on the floor. But also inside they had the Holy Ark and they were doing sacrifices. Nobody would get the same feeling because you wouldn't see any of these external trappings pointing you to the significance of the building. So if you were a good Jew and knew what was happening inside, you'd feel the awe. But it would be lacking. You'd feel that I'm missing something here. That's how you would feel. This concept, it really applies in many places in Jewish life. There's an idea of hiddur mitzvah. That a mitzvah should be beautified. So technically, you can take, you know, an old, dingy, smelly talis, and you can put on dirty tzitzis, and you can make your bracha and do the mitzvah, and you fulfill that mitzvah of the Torah. But there's an idea of taking a beautiful talis. It should be clean and white. People decorate it with, you know, the fancy ataras on top with some gold and silver, and people have their designs on it sometimes. And the idea is that you should beautify a mitzvah, because we're trying to show what I'm doing here is something very significant. When we come to, let's say, having a meal on Shabbos, so technically, according to the halacha, you can take out a peanut butter sandwich, you know, you make your bracha motzi, eat it, you know, you've done your job. Say kiddush, you've done your job. But you want to have a beautiful tablecloth, you want to take out the nice plates, you want to be able to have nice food, because you're showing that this is a significant day of the week. Right now, I'm fulfilling God's command of keeping Shabbos and enjoying Shabbos. So you want to make sure that even though you enjoy peanut butter, you want to make sure that the table and the atmosphere kind of indicates the significance of the day. Hit or mitzvah. We have an idea that, you know, you can take an esrog on Sukkot, and there's rules of what the esrog has to look like, but you could fit the rules. It could have a dot here and there. It could be a funny shape. You know, there's a lot of ways you can pass an esrog as valid. But we try to get the nicest esrog we can find. You want to get one that's clean and symmetrical and yellow. And why? Because you want to beautify the mitzvah. Because if you show that the externals look beautiful, that's the indication to us that there's something very special happening here. That's the idea of hiddur mitzvah, beautifying mitzvahs. You find that when it comes to a shul. Now, a lot of times shuls begin and they have to start off, you know, with very humble, very humble surroundings. But as a shul grows, hopefully they're able to expand and renovate and decorate in a way that this looks like an honorable place to serve God. You know, you could say, well, it's all about the prayer anyway, so why do I have to have a fancy shul? You know, as long as there's a room and there's, you know, some chairs to sit down in, so the shul is fine. Why do I have to make it that you have stained glass windows and you have a nice big ceiling and you have, you know, artwork or nice carpets or nice benches? Why do you need that? And the answer is, again, you're trying to indicate that what we're doing here is very significant. And people should have that feeling, because we actually, you know, the first thing that you see is the externals. You walk into the building, what do you see first? You don't see the beautiful prayers. You see the walls and you see the windows and you see the ceiling. That's what you see. In the door. Right. So to get yourself into the mood and to get us to recognize the fact what's happening here is extremely significant, the externals should therefore indicate what's happening inside. It applies also, like we said, to dress. The way a person dresses indicates, you know, what they're doing, who they are. There's a way that we dress at special events versus the way we dress when we go to do exercise, right? And there's a way certain people in important positions dress all the time to show that they have an important position. We expect that the president's addressed in a certain way. If you see him dressed in a different way, it makes you feel, you know, you question it. You know, I thought this person was a person of honor. Why is he dressing that way? In modern times, the idea of dress has been less emphasized than I think used to be, you know, in previous centuries and in previous decades even. But it's still there. It's still there. And that's supposed to indicate to us the importance of the person or the position or the events. But that's what dress is supposed to do as well. So on the other hand, let's say the externals indicated something special happening here, but there was nothing going on, right? You can have this beautiful building with beautiful architecture and expensive materials and great artwork, but inside, you know, there's nothing of significance. So that's actually deceiving. We say looks can be deceiving, right? There's the concept we even say in Eish Hashchayil, we mentioned Sheker Achein VeHevel HaYofi, that beauty is something which is empty. It's meaningless. When is it meaningless? When the beauty doesn't show anything in the inside. When Eish Hashchayil is speaking about the beautiful woman. So if a beautiful woman has a beautiful inside, so that's a complete picture. You see the beauty on the outside and on the inside. If the woman is beautiful externally, but inside she's rotten and deceptive and mean and corrupt, so then it's Hevel HaYofi, it's the beauty which is worthless. It's an empty beauty, because the beauty is just a shell which has nothing to show for itself. So that's part of the idea of the externals showing the internals. And if the externals indicate something which is not true, that we look at as a lie. It's false. It's deceptive. So practically, a person is entering into the Beis HaMikdash. And people went to the Beis HaMikdash really for one of two reasons. You'd go there either for atonement. A person who has sinned would go and offer a sacrifice for atonement. Or you go there just to experience God, to come closer. So, and it could be you're doing both. But either you're going there to be forgiven for sins you've done, or you're going there to be able to connect with God in a deeper way. So when you come close to the building, The building should engender this respect or reverence from those who are coming in. That's what it should be. If you enter the building and everything seems to be very casual and laid back and, you know, nothing seems to be all that important, so then you would lose your focus as well. The place wouldn't be you wouldn't be entering in the proper way to serve God and to connect with God. So the basic mikdash has to be something which, from your initial approach all the way into your inside, you felt the awe of the building. Both the externals and then also what was happening inside, the content and the internal goings on of the building. That's basic mikdash. So people approaching from afar, even in the middle of the night, they'd see guards standing guard all around the complex. Not because they're scared of enemies, but to show, this is a very important building I'm about to approach. Then you walk through and there are these fancy large gates and these big walls, and you go inside and there's more huge gates and walls and decorations. There's even this, they describe there were gold crowns in the windows, and there was a gold decorated grapevine hanging from the top of the door. I mean, everything there was just adorned and decorated in beautiful ways. That's all to get us in the proper mood to know that I'm about to enter into God's palace. And then once you have that attitude, you can connect with God in a much deeper, in a much more sincere way. So that's one idea of these guards. But that's one approach. But I saw two deeper approaches discussed also in commentaries. One approach is that when you have guards around something, it's symbolic of something else. It's symbolic that there's an inside and there's an outside. And there's something they want to keep out and something they want to have to come in. So that's symbolic. What does it mean? It means that it's a model for us. Meaning that we're about to go in there to serve God, to offer sacrifices, to pray, to connect. We have to make sure that no external motives, selfish or impure motives, enter into our service of God. So there's this building which is totally surrounded and guarded. And this is the place of purity, this is the place where God is my focus 100%. The outside represents other concerns. Outside that building represents our own personal selfish needs or ulterior motives that we have in terms of, you know, gaining money or fame, whatever else we want. But inside this building, you have to make sure that all those things are left outside. You can't have any of your own selfish motivations entering into the Beis HaMikdash. So the idea of having guards outside is a model for us to show how we're supposed to serve God. Now, it's a very lofty goal to serve God in a sincere way. Many people serve God, we call this in Hebrew, lishma, to serve God lishma, to serve God just with sincere motivations, for the sake of doing the right thing. It is a lofty goal, but when you're entering the Beis HaMikdash, it's something that has to be on our minds. We have to know, when we go to serve God, we have to make sure all those other motives, all those other thoughts are left outside, and we go inside here, we're doing just what has to be done. So when you see these guards, and it could be a symbol for us that all external influences or external ideas are left outside and we just go to serve God. It's true in the Beis HaMikdash, but it's also true in any time we serve God, any mitzvah we do. When we go to pray in shul on Shabbos, or we go to eat pizza matzah on Pesach, or we go to hear the shofar Rosh Hashanah, any mitzvah that we do. So the goal always is that I should do this purely because it's the will of God. I want to do it because God said so and it's the right thing to do. And I'm not doing it just because it feels good for me or because my friends are doing it or because I enjoy eating knedlach or because I, you know, Rosh Hashanah is a fun time to spend with friends. I'm doing it because I'm serving God who told me to do these things. And we have to try to have that focus in every mitzvah that we do. So the Beis HaMikdash is always used as kind of like the ideal world. It's a model of the ideal Jew and the ideal world to live in. And that ideal world has guards on the outside saying that you leave all of your personal motivations outside. You come in here being sincere. And that's the goal, really, in every step of Jewish life. So that's one deeper meaning you have in terms of these guards. Now, the second deeper meaning, another symbolic meaning, which is that we mentioned before, there are 24 guards stationed around the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the number 24, does anyone know its significance? What else do we have of 24 in Judaism? It's not a common number, but there is one obvious connection, if you have it in your mind. 24.
Well,
12
tribes.
24
by
2.
Is it the number of, Kohanim families? Didn't they have a certain number of
That's families? Also true. I wasn't thinking that. There were 24 families. Yes, that's true. Yeah, that's true. That is true. That is true. I was thinking about that one. That's a good one. Right. There's another one. And they probably all connect, but they do all connect. There's 24 books of the Tanakh. 24 books of the Tanakh. So we have 24 guards, 24 Kohanim families, as Richard's pointing out, which is right, and then 24 books of Tanakh. So if these guards are corresponding to the books of Tanakh, what does that mean for us? It means that the true protection of the Jewish people is based on the Torah. That's what it means, on our observance and study of the Torah. So every guard represents his own book of the Tanakh, and all together they create this shmira, this protection over us, over the Jewish people. And we know that the Torah itself tells us over and over and over again, if you listen to God and study His Torah, then you'll be protected and enemies won't touch you and you'll get all these blessings. And if you disobey God and don't study the Torah, then that's when the enemies come in, that's when everything falls apart. And that's repeated over and over again. Right? Right? You know, it's hard to know, but it's I mean, this is the general rule for all of history, you know, so, I mean, in a broader sense, the answer always will be yes to that question, but to know what do we do different this month than last month, I mean, that's always what we can answer. But the Torah tells us over and over again that our protection is based on our observance of the Torah, our devotion to Torah study. If we live life with Torah, learn Torah, then we get the protection. And if not, then God says the protection is removed. Yeah. This we have five Torah.
And then
I don't know offhand, I have to count it up.
Then,
I don't know offhand, we have to let's do it. Look at, we can look it up, it's very easy to look up. But okay. That's the split. But that's our true protection. And the truth is, it's interesting, the guards were the Kohanim and the Levim. And the Kohanim and Levim are viewed as the tribe which were our Torah teachers in history. It says Sifsei Kohen Yishmeru Das, that the lips of the Kohen guards the faith, the Torah Hashem Yivakshepiyo, and you should seek the Torah from the Kohen. And we know that the purpose of the whole tribe of Levi was they did not have farmland; their job was to serve in the temple and teach Torah. It says Yoru Mishpatechel Yaakov, the tribe of Levi are those who will teach the laws of God to Jacob, to the Jewish people. That's what it says in the Torah. So the Levites and the Kohanim, they were our Torah teachers. They took on the job of being the guardians of the temple, and they represent the 24 books of the Tanakh, which is really the true protection of the Jewish people. So they had the actual job of guarding. That was an actual job they had to do. But symbolically, it's telling us that you have to realize where true protection does come from. It comes from those people who are your Torah teachers, who are teaching you that the study of Torah and the observance of Torah, the 24 books of Tanakh, that's how Jewish people is protected. And that's what happened in Jewish history. I mean, even when we mentioned that, okay, what happened this month versus last month, that there's so many terrorist attacks, and last month there weren't. We don't know. But we do know that what percentage of Jews at this point in history is actually involved and connected in Torah study and Torah observance? Unfortunately, a very small percentage, relatively. You know, I think maybe 10%, 15%, I don't know what the percentage is, but...
In the world or in Israel?
Worldwide. You know, Israel, even, you know, also you can ask, but worldwide for sure. In Israel is a higher percentage, I think. But I don't know if it's half even, but there's a higher percentage in Israel. Probably more than half. I don't know. But worldwide, certainly, the percentage is very low.
Did you say half in Israel?
Israel, I think, I would guess it's probably around half. You know, that's my guess. I'm not really sure. But yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, we could do better, but it's pretty good. You know? But so, why things happen when they happen, we don't know. But certainly, in the past 2,000 years, since we've been exiled from our land, when the temple was destroyed, so Jewish observance and Torah study has certainly decreased fairly regularly over the years. And even though now we think, okay, we're doing okay, but you look at worldwide Jewry, we're really not doing all that great in terms of Torah study and Torah observance. So the protection that we need is really based on that, and that's something which we always have to strengthen at times like this especially. You know, people discuss and people ask, what can I do sitting here in America to protect the Jews in Israel? And yes, it's important to support the army and send in donations and everything like that. But the more that we become connected to the Torah and its mitzvos, so that itself creates protection of our brethren in Eretz Yisrael. So that's something we always should think about. But that's these 24 guards, they correspond to the 24 books of Tanakh, and that shows us the power of the Torah to protect us from harm. So that's one aspect of these guards. Now, there's a second aspect of the guards. So the guards, on the one hand, are there just to show honor. And they're not to protect from any enemies. They're there just to show honor to the temple. But there was another job they had. The Torah tells us that there are a lot of people who weren't allowed to enter into the temple. You couldn't enter in if you were tameh, if you're spiritually impure. You couldn't enter in if you're a mourner. Mourners weren't allowed to go into the temple. We know that if you weren't a Kohen, you couldn't perform the service. Only Kohen can perform the service. So part of the idea of the guards, they're kind of like bouncers. You know, they had to check you at the door to make sure that you were allowed to come in. And if you went to actually perform one of the services, they'd make sure you're actually a Kohen, a kosher Kohen to perform the service. So that's interesting. When it came to the Kohanim, they actually were all approved by the Beis Din. There was a Beis Din that sat there in the temple, and they would, before you actually approached to serve, they would check you out. And they would go into your lineage and make sure that you're a kosher Kohen. If a non-Kohen approached the Avodah, they'd have to just say, stand back. You know, they would know who wasn't a Kohen. Only if you're a card-carrying Kohen could you actually perform any Avodah in the Beis Din Mikdash, any of the services. But part of the job is that they had to make sure that only Kohanim were doing the service, and only those entering who are allowed to enter the temple can enter the temple. That was the job. Now, the source of this is actually in Parshas Korach. Korach was the one who rebelled against Moshe, and Korach and his followers, they said that, why are you taking the leadership of the Jews, and why is your brother Aaron the Kohen Gadol? We're all holy, we're all God's people, we all heard God speak about Sinai, we should all be able to serve as Kohanim. That was their claim against Moshe. In Parshas Korach, you know, God showed them who was right. God said, it's from me. I'm the one who directed Moshe. It's not nepotism. I told Moshe to become the leader and Aaron to become the Kohen Gadol. It's my decision based on their righteousness. And he punished all the followers of Korach. But in Parshas Korach, so that's where we affirmed the status of Kohanim for all eternity. And that's where God gives the mitzvah that we should keep out those who aren't Kohanim from doing the service. So it kind of fits very much the context of that parsha. Because we had there 250 members of, I think it was the tribe of Reuven, who wanted to serve as Kohanim, and they were all killed in a miraculous way by God during this episode. So God says, I want you to know the Kohanim are my people. They're the ones that I have selected to serve in the temple. And the rest of you, even though you're holy, nice Jews, it's not your role. You have different roles. But the role of the Kohanim is to serve the temple only. So at that point, now God deemed the Kohanim as the servants of, as his servants for all of history. And he says, and make sure that you keep out any non-Kohen from doing any of the service. And that was part of the role of the Kohanim. Now there's an interesting point pointed out here by Rabbi Rucham Lavovitz. Rabbi Rucham Lavovitz was the Mashkiach, the spiritual advisor of the Mir Yeshiva. But back in Europe before World War II, before they escaped and went to Shanghai and then to Israel. But he was a well-known Baal Musar, somebody who put out, who used to speak and teach many, and we have a lot of published works from him. He makes a very interesting point. He says that the Torah already commands a non-Kohen not to serve the temple. It says in the Torah that only a Kohen can serve the temple. So that should be enough, we would think. Like, for instance, the Torah says, don't eat pork chops, right? So that should stop you from eating pork chops. We don't have a whole tribe on patrol by the pork chops. No, stand back. No one touch the pork chops. We say God said don't eat in the Torah, so hopefully the Jews will follow that. If they don't, they don't. But we don't have to have a police force standing at every single pork chop store. I'm telling you, stay back from the pork chops. When it comes to this mitzvah, though, so God says if you're not a Kohen, you can't serve. And then God says, not only that, I'm putting an entire tribe on guard. And anybody tries to approach it, they're going to say, get out of here, and push you back. So God had to make bouncers when it came to this mitzvah more than other mitzvahs. And the question is why? Why does this mitzvah get specifically have to have a whole patrol, a whole tribe there to stand guard against it? So Rav Yerucham writes, he says that we see from here a very, very important point. We see the tremendous an intense drive the Jews had to connect with God. Meaning here we're talking about service in the temple. Now a Jew who's in tune with spirituality and wants to connect with God, they should have this passionate drive. I just wish I can go and I could offer the incense. I wish I could go and I wish I could sprinkle the blood on the altar. Because that was such a tremendous spiritual high that the Kohanim would have. And every single Jew wanted to have an opportunity for that. And if God felt it's not enough for me to command them to stay back, they're going to want to do it anyways because they have such a drive for this. So therefore, I have to put a whole staff of guards on guard to make sure it doesn't happen. Now, we find something very similar at Mount Sinai. When the Jews stood around the mountain, so God said that no one's allowed on the mountain besides Moshe. Everyone else has to stay back. And God commanded the Jews, okay, everyone stay back to the mountain. But if you look at the Torah in Parshas Yisro, that command is given several times. God keeps telling Moshe, tell the Jews to stand back, tell them to stand back, tell them to stand back, over and over again. And Rashi tells us, why do we repeat that command so many times? Because the Jews had such a desire, they had this yearning, passionate drive, they wanted to come close to God, they weren't going to listen. They were almost ready to race up the mountain and try to, like, you know, connect with God in some way, like Moshe did. So God had to warn them over and over again, stand back from the mountain, don't touch the mountain, because or else they were going to lose control and run up the mountain and try to get to God. That's what Rashi tells us. But we see there as well that there was a tremendous drive, like a burning passion, a desire to connect with God for spirituality. Now, on our level, it's hard to understand sometimes. I mean, we've seen if you ever go to like an event and they yell, the buffet is open. Then we see everyone running to the buffet, right? We know what that's like, you know? Everyone races there, you try to get first in line, you grab your plate, you try to get in there. That we know about. But if someone says, okay, right now the shul is open, everyone come into Davin, we don't find that same burst of energy to run into the shul, right? We don't find that. But in the Beis HaMikdash, the people are on a very high level, at Mount Sinai they're on a very high level, and people had this burning desire for spirituality. And when they were told, okay, you can enter into the Beis HaMikdash and offer sacrifices, they couldn't wait, and they were running in. And they had to be stopped and say, this is as far as you can go. Past this line is only for Kohanim. This is the last place you can be as a regular Jew. But then this drive to connect, to have the pleasure of spirituality, which is something that we find difficult to understand sometimes. Do we understand the idea of having a drive to connect for God? We might know it's the right thing to do. We might know that it's something appropriate and as Jews it's something we should pursue. But to feel it in the same way that we have the drive to run to the buffet, I don't think we feel that all the time. We understand what it means to desire a piece of cake. But it's based on our lower level that we're at this point in history that we don't understand the desire for spirituality in the same way. Yeah.
There must be some prohibition then against Jews looking at rock stars, because what you describe, you see clips of a rock star or somebody showing up, and the security is just levels and levels.
Yeah,
security,
right.
You just want to break through it. It just sounds like the same thing. So is there a prohibition, but is there, like, do our children learn not to worship?
I think that's a good word, is worship, because, we only worship God, right? But you do find in culture people do worship rock stars, sports heroes, you know? So, I wouldn't tell you there's a prohibition for someone to watch a rock star, but definitely in terms of what you want to educate children in is that, where we want to focus our worship, as it were, that those things which we feel are significant are not the rock stars, the sports heroes. It's people who are doing the right things, people who study Torah and do mitzvot and help others, and that's where we try to put our focus. So I definitely feel that it's appropriate to teach that. I can't say there's a prohibition against it, but I definitely feel it's appropriate to teach that, for sure. But even to teach somebody, okay, there's no reason to run for the buffet, walk to the buffet. I think that's also appropriate. You can run to shul. But the Gemara actually says that one should run into shul. Because that's the idea. You're trying to show this is the thing I can't wait to do. This is my excitement lies in the service of God. So it says even on Shabbos one is allowed to run to shul. Usually you're not supposed to run on Shabbos. It's just on Shabbos you take it easy. But even on Shabbos you can run into shul because that's where our greatest desire should be, is in the service of God. They don't run, but it does say it's good to run. So I have seen individuals do it. I've never seen a whole community running, but. I have seen individuals who do run to shul in my life. even on time. Even on time. Running late is a different story. Even on time. We often read the stories of the Tanakh, and we can't understand why couldn't they hold themselves back from idolatry? Like, I don't understand. Like, why couldn't they hold themselves back from idolatry? You read Tanakh, and over again, they're worshiping idols, and they're running after this idol and that on the other idol. And we look at them with like disdain, and we say, like, how stupid. Like, we would never do that. But the answer is the opposite. They're much more spiritual than us. And they had such a desire to become spiritual. It was misplaced. But it was a desire. So they look at us and say, why are you running for a buffet? Why are you running for a dessert? That's what they look at us to say. They couldn't understand that, because they weren't physical. They were spiritual people. Now, we're much more, we live in a society, in a point of history where we have abundance, in terms of financial abundance, in terms of food, in terms of physicality. And we've become more physical, and we run for the physical. But we can't understand running for spiritual. But I think even those Jews who used to run after idols would look at us, with disdain and say, why are you running after food or money? Why are you doing that? But that's what we do. And but we have to realize, number one, there is a pleasure to be found in spirituality, a tremendous pleasure, which we find hard to relate to at times. The burning desire to run to the Beis HaMikdash was that which required an entire team of Kohanim to stop the Jews from going too far. And for us, we have to at least have that appreciation, to have a taste of that there is a certain pleasure and ecstasy in the spiritual. In Torah study, in mitzvahs, in prayer. And there are Jews out there who do feel it. You can look around at different shuls, and you look at certain people, and you see how they daven. And they seem to be in such a high state of happiness when they're in the middle of their davening. And then we say, when I daven, I'm just reading words. I don't feel so excited and happy. You look at Jews, and they go to help another Jew, and they're doing a chesed, and you say, this person seems to be on the top of the world. He seems so happy. And we do it begrudgingly, because we feel it's a nice thing to do, but we don't feel good about it. You look at Jews who are studying Torah, and they look like they're in a different planet. They're so into it. And we don't feel the same way all the time. But there is a way to develop a true desire and pleasure in spirituality. And that's something that I think people were much more in tune with in previous generations. I think that we're less in tune with it. But we can still access it. It's still there. There's a story, again, I can't confirm how accurate it is or not, but there's a story which is told of Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, a great Hasidic Rebbe. And he was known for his love of Jews, his love of mitzvahs, somebody with a lot of passion and a lot of love within him. And the story is told that it was the first morning of Sukkot, and he was so excited to take his lulav and esrog. And he woke up really early, in the middle of the night, and he was like watching his watch, waiting for the time to come. Because you can only start in the morning to take a bracha lulav and esrog. So he had his esrog in front of him. He put it into his break front. It was a mitzvah item. He wanted to put it in there with his silver vessel he had. It was in his break front. And he's watching his watch, and finally the time came for it, and he bashed his hand through the glass to grab the esrog. His hand, obviously, I'm sure he got hurt. His hand was bloody, whatever it was. But he had such an excitement, he just lost control. And he couldn't hold back. It's 6:30 in the morning now, quick! And he grabs it. He goes right through the break front. But because the excitement for mitzvahs was there, such an excitement for a mitzvah, he just couldn't control himself. Just like the Jews in Mount Sinai, just like the Jews in the base of Mikdash, they just couldn't hold back. And we had to say, no, stop. You have to control yourself. You're not supposed to do this. But they had such that they had this yearning desire to serve God, they just couldn't control it. So it's a lesson for us, just to be able to perceive that if you do try, you can achieve pleasure in the service of God. I actually read a piece recently that described that why is it that we don't always feel pleasure in doing mitzvahs? It's because we don't put forth our full effort in the mitzvah. Like for instance, if somebody is trying to, let's say you're building a house. So the true joy in building a house is once it's completed, you can move in. When it's just the shell and some beams and some cement at the foundation, so you're anticipating the building and you're not excited quite yet. The excitement, the true joy in having is when you get the complete product. So in mitzvah as well, the excitement comes when you do the complete product. So for instance, if you want to have a joy in let's say, like we said before, in prayer. So by finding a joy in prayer, davening comes through having a complete product. So if we do it, half-heartedly, and we don't think about the words, or we rush through it, or we don't prepare ourselves beforehand, so then why do we expect to find it pleasurable? It's only a half-hearted project. It's half-baked. Just like it's a house, it's only half-built. If you put yourself into it fully, you say, okay, this Shabbos morning I'm going to go to shul, and I'm going to try to get there on time, and I'm going to get myself ready for it, and I'm going to take my sitter, and I'm going to think what the words mean, and really try to connect. They put myself into it, and it's a lot of work, it takes a lot of energy, but that's where you're going to find joy, because now it's a complete product. It's true with any mitzvah. If we're supposed to eat matzah on Pesach. So most of us eat the matzah. But if you beforehand you say, no, I'm going to do it right. And I'm going to learn about matzah beforehand and understand its meaning, understand the rules of making matzah. And when it comes to the time to eat the matzah, I'm going to focus on what I'm about to do, and I'm going to eat it and savor each bite. And then you feel the pleasure of the mitzvah because you actually have a complete product. But anytime your product's only half-baked, no pun intended with the matzah, but you know, it's a half-baked product, you don't feel a joy in it. So that's what's the lesson. The joy in mitzvah is something which we're supposed to feel. It's one of the pillars of Judaism, is to feel a simcha, a happiness in our service of God. We have to make sure that we get there. So let's just take it back for a second. So these guards at the temple, one of their jobs was to keep out the Jews who weren't supposed to come in. Even though God told those Jews in the Torah, you can't come in here, they were to come in anyways. And they had to have guards to keep them out because of their excitement to perform mitzvah, because of that desire, the burning and yearning desire they had to perform mitzvah. So we're just to recap quickly. So these guards at the temple really had two purposes. One purpose was to show honor to the building. They were there not to keep out any enemies. They were stationed there all night long, and they were to show this building's real significance. So we discussed the idea of how the externals are supposed to be there to promote the internals. We mentioned the idea of keeping out ulterior motives and external desires and selfishness from our service of God. Guards kind of keep things out from what's supposed to be in. We talked about the 24 guards correspond to 24 books of Tanakh, of the Torah, because Torah is our true protection. And then we discussed this idea that the guards also had a job to keep out the people who weren't supposed to come in, who couldn't control themselves. And these people, they couldn't control themselves not because, you know, they had no self-control, because they had such a desire to serve God, they wanted to go in and feel the spiritual rush of the temple. Similar to the way we would run to the buffet. that's the lessons of these guards. Any questions?